From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Big news in the cyber crime world this week. A $6 billion headline and what U.S. prosecutors are calling perhaps the biggest money laundering scheme in history. Seven top operators of the online currency exchange Liberty Reserve have been charged with running a black market bank, an online bank for global drug dealers, child pornographers, identity thieves, and hackers to move money, no questions asked. Now Liberty Reserve is shut down, but it's a big window into a dark world. This hour On Point, the internet and money, and a charge of massive money laundering. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. What do you see here? Internet freedom or PayPal for gangsters? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. They marched out in New York on Tuesday with the announcement. Here was U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara saying at a press conference that the U.S. government is stepping up its law enforcement efforts to go after online money laundering.
As alleged, the only liberty that Liberty Reserve gave many of its users was the freedom to commit crimes, as it became a popular hub for fraudsters, hackers, and traffickers. The global enforcement action that we announced today is an important step towards reining in the Wild West of illicit internet banking.
The Wild West of illicit internet banking. And who would use this service if they could step out of the mists of time? Well, here's one, said the IRS's Richard Weber.
If Al Capone were alive today, this is how he would be hiding his money. Capitalizing on this emerging demand to cyber launder, it is alleged that Liberty Reserve moves staggering amounts of illegal funds.
And what was going on globally out of the bank's operations in Costa Rica? Here's Preet Bharara again.
It was essentially a black market bank. As alleged, Liberty Reserve deliberately operated in a way to attract and aid criminals who wished to use digital currency to break the law and to launder the proceeds of their crimes. Serious crimes, including credit card fraud, identity theft, investment fraud, computer hacking, child pornography, and even narcotics trafficking.
There, the U.S. prosecutor, U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara in New York on Tuesday. For the latest on the Liberty Reserve case, we go to New York and Reid Albergati, reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He covers finance and banking crime. Reid, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So give us a description of this operation. How was it put together? What is it alleged it did?
So basically what it was a mechanism for alleged criminals to pay each other without leaving a paper trail. So let's say you have a guy in Russia who is selling, you know, stolen credit card information that he got off the internet from hacking it.
Okay.
And he wants to sell that to someone in the United States, let's say, who wants to go and buy things with those stolen credit card numbers. Well, how do they pay each other? Well, you know, the old-fashioned way is you pay in cash or maybe you send a check. Well, criminals don't really want to send a check to each other and leave a paper trail. So what this website did was allow them to anonymously transfer funds to this website and then, without any traces whatsoever, pay each other and then extract the money, much like you would, you know, from PayPal, through these transfer services who sort of played along. So really, the crime here that Liberty Reserve and the founders are accused of committing is purposely trying to, with criminal intent, create a system designed for criminals. So it's really actually interesting. I mean, this is just it's a brave new world of crime when it comes to the internet.
The Wild West. I mean, the nuance here is interesting because what they would typically go to transfer services in Nigeria or somewhere and get their cash or the money moved into a kind of uncurrency, Liberty Reserve's own denomination before it was cashed back out again. Is that right, Reid?
Yeah, it is. And Liberty, they actually had a name. It was LR dollars or LRs, which obviously stands for Liberty Reserve. So they would pay each other in LRs. And, of course, every time they're paying each other, there are fees being charged, and Liberty Reserve was making a lot of money on all these transfers. But, you know, according to the allegations, you know, criminals don't necessarily care if they're having to pay fees because, you know, this is all crime anyway. So just the cost of doing business when you're stealing credit cards or, you know, buying and selling drugs or, you know, selling child pornography.
$6 billion moved in this way with 55 million transactions?
Yeah.
That is a lot of participation.
It is. In fact, you know, a million people, not a million transactions, but a million people using this, and allegedly 200,000 in the U.S. So, you know, I just did a little Google search, and that's the population of Montgomery, Alabama. So it's a lot of people using this site for allegedly criminal activities. Now, granted, I mean, some of those people could be, there could be legitimate users who just were using this as a way to, you know, transfer funds on the internet. This is a whole, there are a lot of legitimate services like this, but the difference here is that they didn't follow the rules in terms of knowing your customer. There are all kinds of regulations in almost every developed country now where banks have to jump through a lot of hoops to learn who their customers are for this very purpose, to make sure that they're not, you know, using these monetary systems to commit crimes.
And, of course, the allegation is that Liberty Reserve deliberately, very clearly set it up so that you could maintain your anonymity. You had to put in a name and just a little bit of information, an email address. But here's Preet Bharara again talking about just how bogus that could all be. In fact, one of their agents went and signed up using the name Joe Bogus. Here's the U.S. attorney describing that.
An undercover agent working as part of this group was able to register an account at Liberty Reserve using the name Joe Bogus, the account name to steal everything, and the address 123 Fake Main Street in completely made-up city, USA.
The undercover agent, could you hear that?
Yeah.
Signed in as Joe Bogus, address 123 Fake Main Street, and then where, what city? Completely made-up city, USA, and it sailed right through with Liberty Reserve.
Right, right. And Preet said, perhaps some of you live there in the press conference.
Maybe
he's got a good sense of humor. But, you know, I think that what he's saying here is that they were so confident that they were anonymous that they were just brazenly actually describing their crimes in the transactions. So, you know, it was like
people said Russian hacker or whatever in their sort of account name.
Yeah, one person in a transaction actually described it as, you know, buying cocaine or something. You know, Preet said that in the press conference. So, you know, they were very confident that this would work. And, you know, one thing that's interesting that you might want to pay attention to is that the founder here moved to Costa Rica and then later actually gave up his U.S. citizenship.
This is a 39-year-old Ukrainian native, Arthur Budovsky, you're talking about.
Right, I'm talking about him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think there was a feeling that they could get away with these alleged crimes by sort of detaching themselves from the United States. And what caught them really was that even though this was an online currency, an imaginary currency, and they were selling LRs to each other, there still has to be a connection to actual currency.
Somewhere, so you can spend it, so you can realize the value of it.
Yeah, and so, you know, they were using U.S. dollars and some of the transactions went through New York. So even though the people who were committing the crimes may have never even gone to New York and the founders weren't even U.S. citizens, they were in Costa Rica, there's this jurisdictional tie to New York, no matter where people are. And the U.S. government, the Department of Justice, has become more and more comfortable with really extending the arm of the law into other countries. And this thing involved, I think, 17 countries and, you know, seized bank accounts all over the world. So it's really law enforcement when it comes to these sorts of crimes. It's just expanding its power. And I think, you know, for some people, they might even feel a little uncomfortable with that.
Seven charged, five arrested. Budovsky, the founder here, along with Vladimir Katz, Mark Marmolev, Maxim Chukarev, and Azadine El Amin. You know, with a million users, I mean, is it credible when the prosecutors say this was a criminal operation? How do they know this was child pornographers and hackers and identity theft folks? Did they track all that down? Is that the case?
I think it's a great question because when I looked at the indictment, one of the things I thought was, well, if there really are a million criminals, including 200,000 in the U.S., you know, when
we
are
got
we
a crime
see?
Wave?
Yeah, I mean, and when are we going to see some of those people? I mean, not one of the people charged here is actually accused of committing one of those specific crimes, you know, child pornography or drug dealing. I mean, they're accused of conspiracy to commit money laundering. So not even money laundering itself, just conspiracy, because they were, you know, allegedly purposely creating a system where people could use it for that purpose. So
will this be a precedent-setting case when and if they get it to court?
Well, I think it will be. I mean, I don't know in terms of, you know, will it go to the Supreme Court and set that kind of precedent? I don't know. But, I mean, it certainly sets kind of a precedent in terms of law enforcement and what they're willing and capable of doing. But I think you just, you know, you asked a great question. It's just like, how do we exactly know? Like, for instance, Joe Bogus, who said, you know, he was using the service to sell cocaine and buy stolen credit cards. Well, yeah, I mean, he said that,
yeah.
But what do we know that that's really what he was doing? I mean, suppose it was just some kid, you know, messing around. I mean, prosecutors evidently do know this. There's some things they're not telling us yet. They do tend to hold some of these things close to the vest sometimes. But, you know, I think it's a really good question and an important question to ask.
Well, they're going at it very hard right now, this brave new criminal world, U.S. prosecutors say, of dark online banking, money laundering on a grand scale. Reid Albergati with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks very much for being with us today, Reid.
Absolutely.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, a little online slot machine sound right there. We're talking today about grand-scale money laundering alleged online, the sprawling world of criminal banking, we're told, and the story of Liberty Reserve, 5 arrests this week, and an alleged $6 billion money laundering operation busted. Here's a press conference at Tuesday again in New York. IRS criminal investigation head Richard Weber calling the shutdown of Liberty Reserve a victory for law enforcement.
Our efforts today shatter the belief among high-tech money launderers that what happens in cyberspace stays in cyberspace. No longer should they lull themselves into a false sense of security, thinking that the Internet provides absolute anonymity.
$6 billion moved through Liberty Reserve in Costa Rica. The founder and 5 in total already arrested, 2 more charged, and they are being sought. And a very big case in the offing here against an alleged black market online bank. With us right now from Arlington, Virginia, is Brian Krebs, investigative reporter, author of the KrebsOnSecurity.com site, widely read daily blog on computer security and cybercrime. Brian Krebs is a former reporter for The Washington Post, covered tech policy and privacy, computer security, very, very plugged in and well-known in this world, kind of a hero of reporting on online situations. Brian Krebs, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You've done reporting on this as well, and you know this world extremely well. What do you think of this case? And describe for us the world that this gives, you know, us civilians a little glimpse into. What's going on out there, Brian?
Sure. Well, first of all, if I really want to address one of the questions that you brought up with Reid about, you know, all these users, right? You said, I think, 200,000 users.
Just in the U.S., a million worldwide.
Right. And, you know, who are these people and how can it be that there could be this many people running around exchanging these currencies? And the question, I mean, the thing I wanted to point out is that when you basically, it's not an exaggeration to say, I don't think it's an exaggeration when the Justice Department says or the Treasury Department says, look, they hung out a sign saying they're going to accept, you know, they're not going to have anybody give their privacy, their personal information. Mm-hmm. When you do that, you basically hang out a sign that says, abuse our system.
And, criminals, come here. We're here for you.
Yeah, there's a vacuum in the underground, right? I mean, there are a lot of folks in the underground that are looking for, and I should just preface my remarks by saying I spend a lot of time on dozens of underground forums, and so, you know, my kind of view of this space is colored there. I want to, but I think it's important to note, certainly there were some legitimate users of Liberty Reserve. I don't buy the argument that they're, you know, all crooks. And we can talk, I'd love to talk more about that in a second. But, you know, I think a lot of people, particularly even folks in the media, really had no idea who Liberty Reserve was or what it was all about just a few days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really no reason they would, really. You know, if you go to, for example, you go to a football game or a baseball game, you're almost guaranteed to see ads for like Budweiser and Miller Lite, right?
Yep.
Well, if you spend any time in the cybercrime underground and on various forums where cybercrime wares are bought and sold, Liberty Reserve has kind of been like that.
With the gold standard of I don't know, moving your money quietly?
Right. Well, I mean, not advertising per se, but mm-hmm. but everybody who has something to sell is going to say they, or until recently, is going to say they accept either Liberty Reserve or Web Money or both. And it's kind of like, you know, you walk into a Main Street store, you go to a website online, and you see that Visa and MasterCard logo.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's the same thing in the underground. You see the Liberty Reserve logo and the
amazing. The Web Money out of Moscow, Liberty Reserve out of Costa Rica. Were you surprised to see U.S. prosecutors swoop in here and go for all these arrests, or did it look like a plum just waiting to be plucked?
No, I wasn't surprised for a couple of reasons. First of all, as I said, if you go on the underground sites, if you go on sites selling people's identity, people's credit card, stolen credit card data, anything you can hack and steal for sale, like I said, it's basically Web Money, Liberty Reserve, almost 50-50. And this has been going on for half a decade or more by now. So, you know, the feds have had their eyes on this for a long time. That it took this long to take them down is a little surprising. Given that it turns out that Liberty Reserve wasn't actually registered as a financial institution in Costa Rica, there's some interesting details coming out of the local press there about mm-hmm. This Budovsky guy and what he had going there and stuff. But I don't think it's a surprise to anybody, and I think it's a little overdue, actually.
It was even played a part in, what was it, just a month ago or so, where we had people all over the world who were taking millions out of ATMs, a sort of coordinated flash theft deal. Mm-hmm. And that money is alleged, a bunch of it, to have gone through Liberty Reserve.
Yeah, no surprise. Again, part of what I think part of why it's not surprising that Liberty Reserve got taken down so hard, aside from the fact that they're prevalent, very, very prevalent in the underground and very popular, the government has been ratcheting up the rhetoric saying, look, this anti-money laundering stuff is very, very important. You digital currencies out there, we're looking at you. I think in, in March, March 13th, I think the date mm-hmm. was, the Treasury Department came out and said, look, we got these new regulations for specifically for digital currencies, and you guys need to pay attention because we're serious about this. And interestingly, and I didn't put this together until yesterday, but Web Money that very same day said, we're not going to allow U.S. customers to register new accounts anymore.
Ah.
And
because they're afraid U.S. law would come right behind them.
Well, I think they just kind of made a calculation and said, is it worth it? And are these – and I think maybe a little more cynically, they look at it and they go, well, if people really want to register on our site, they're going to find a way.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say they're not from America, right? But
yeah, yeah, that's pretty much
anonymous. The same thing.
So say whatever you want for an address and off you go. I mean, the government's
right,
indictment here, they said that the merchants, quote unquote, who accepted Liberty Reserve's currency, its own currency. This is reading from the government indictment included, as you report here, traffickers of stolen credit card data and personal identity information, peddlers of various types of online Ponzi and get-rich schemes, computer hackers for hire, unregulated gambling enterprises, underground drug dealing websites, and they went out of their way also to say child pornographers. I guess this is a very big world, $6 billion just through this site, Brian.
Yeah, I think it's a lot bigger than most people realize. I really appreciate the fact that they put financial numbers on, or estimates, I should say. The government tends to sort of
fuzz.
Make these, yeah, a little bigger than they usually are. But I mean, $1.4 billion annually through Liberty Reserve kind of gives you an idea. I mean, they're not exactly half the market for digital currencies, but probably between 40% and 50%. And Liberty, Web Money, the Russian digital currency, which by the way is several years older, probably between 40% and 60%. Gives you a good idea of how much money is coursing through the underground and just how valuable this information is.
It raises a lot of questions we want to dig into here. Let's bring our listeners in as well. Lexington, Kentucky, Don is calling. Hi, Don, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Where is this money that is illegal now, and can it be seized? And what is this amount of money? You mentioned $6 billion compared to, say, offshore banking amounts.
Yeah, tiny, I think. But yeah, let's look at that. The $6 billion, where is that money now, Brian?
That's a very good question. I know that they had Liberty Reserve was alleged to have also offshore accounts. It's not entirely clear if the government was able to seize all that money, but they're saying they have, and they're saying they've created some kind of process. Last time I called the number, they had these two numbers that said if you have money in the system and you want it back, or hey, if you have a tip for us about the criminal activity in this network, give us a call.
Yeah.
And we'll try to help you out, right?
But most of that $6 billion would already have moved through the Liberty Reserve system and be presumably, if the government's right, in the pockets of some criminal somewhere already and gone, right?
You would think so. But look, if you run a service, let's say, take for example, I run a service where, and by the way, this is the way the underground is structured. There are lots and lots of service providers.
Yeah.
You can think of them as turnkey services. So I'm a guy, I know how to do botnets, or I know how to do spam, right? And so I offer a service that lets other people use my spam resources.
Okay.
And I might charge them a monthly fee and a registration fee and whatnot.
Same for dark banking?
Sure, yeah, and it doesn't matter. So mm-hmm. cashing out hacked accounts, phishing kits, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And the list goes on and on. And, it does include child pornography and stuff like that. But more typically, you see these turnkey systems. But a lot of these people are on a payment plan. Believe it or not, they're renting services on a monthly basis. And so the folks providing these services tend to keep pretty large balances at Liberty Reserve. Because they don't get around to cashing it out every day.
But they only seized $25 million, if I read correctly.
Is that right? Well, $25 million or $25,000. I mean, it all depends. Are you the account holder who got screwed?
and to the other question about offshore accounts, we were talking about offshore accounts on this show recently, and I think there are, if I read correctly, there are trillions in offshore accounts. So, we've got a lot of listeners who are writing in here and saying, come on, they're going after the online guys, but the big boys do all kinds of shenanigans. And just the regular offshore accounts are very robust and much deeper in cash than Liberty Reserve
certainly.
Was.
Yeah, certainly. I think that's true. One thing to keep in mind, though, about the way the digital underground works is in a lot of these offshore banking situations where you have some, high-rolling mobster who's got $100 million to invest in some, real estate venture in Eastern Europe or something to basically launder his money. I mean, you're talking about people who have physical access to, offshore financial havens. I mean, they go there and meet with people. But what you're talking about with cybercrime is there are a lot of folks who say, well, what is cybercrime? Is it a bunch of – is it organized criminals? Is it individuals? I like to talk about cybercrime – the way I see it is more sort of a confederation of independent contractors. And most of these people have never, ever met face-to-face. So that's why these currencies, these virtual currencies, are so important because the trust is basically based on your reputation, like your eBay score, except there's a score for reputation of how many transactions you have in the underground.
Confederation of independent contractors. Really, a shadow economy. You can see why it freaks out law enforcement, because once it's up and running and on its own sort of rules and means, they have very little insight into it. Brian Krebs, stand by in Arlington, Virginia. Let's get Chris on here from Toronto. Chris, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you know?
Well, it's funny to me because I was involved in an underground economy, but after I left that economy is when I realized how easily the electronic systems of payment can be manipulated. I run a small business, and I've had, I would say, three or four different attempts for somebody to use electronic payment to defraud.
Yeah, happens a lot.
Placing an order with the company, sending the money, and then a few days later, the if it's a credit card transaction, it comes up as a chargeback. Yeah. And by that time, you've given the other party what they're looking for.
Right.
And I've had that happen to me a few times. And when I was in the underground economy.
The underground economy. What sector were you in, Chris?
Right.
Okay. I was a cocaine dealer.
Okay, that's a sector. That's the narcotics sector. All right.
And I mean, with hard cash, you count it. It's right there. It's exchanged for a service or a product, and there's no real problems there. But it's in the legitimate field where there's more penetration of the systems that these big banks think are so impenetrable and defraud people of thousands of millions of dollars each year,
So do you look back and say, what a hassle cocaine was? I had to actually lug it around and carry cash. These guys can do it all with just zeros and ones, Chris.
Well, you know what? The whole thing about that is, I was providing a product to people who were interested. I wasn't some guy on the street corner, slinging crack to crackheads, right? I was dealing with professional people that, needed stress relief or were using it to do their work or what have you, right?
You say so.
This, you're talking about, it wasn't such a big hassle, right? I mean,
they came to you deliberately, whereas these online guys just come and fleece you and you don't even know what happened.
Well, luckily they didn't fleece me because I'm smart enough to get the drop on them and know when I'm about to get fleeced.
Hey,
right?
Brian, what are you thinking as you hear our underground?
I'm raring to jump in. Chris raises a really interesting issue about security, and this is one of the things that was very attractive for many people who accept Liberty Reserve. First of all, security, and I got to tell you, I've never seen anything like the security at Liberty Reserve. I mean, you had to log in, there's like an account number.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, no, wow. But you log in, account number, password, and then a PIN. And then, when you want to go transact, you have these CAPTCHAs that are really hard to see, and you might have to restart the whole process again, then enter your PIN, and then enter a one-time code. And if they don't recognize the IP address, they'll send you an email, and you have to get the code from there and enter that. And,
like Fort Knox,
and then another CAPTCHA,
serious?
And it's, oh, my gosh. But the other thing was that you talked to merchants. Some of the folks who have come out and said, well, wait a minute, we're just legitimate. We accept Liberty Reserve. We lost a lot of money. What is our recourse here? Mm-hmm. A lot of those folks saw Liberty Reserve, and I think rightly so, as a way to sort of hedge against fraud. And I'll give you an example. First of all, they charged very small fees. I mean, PayPal, like 3%, I think, of the total transaction. Liberty Reserve is like 1% plus, I think, like a 75-cent privacy fee or something like
that.
But beyond that, I think it was even on one of the NPR programs, maybe it was Marketplace last night, that they had a guest on who was talking about it. He said, hey, we run a prepaid program, prepaid cards. People can pay for this stuff. And they would pay for it with hacked accounts, and that those charges would get charged back, and we'd be left holding the bag.
Chris in Toronto, I appreciate your look from one era of crime into this new era of crime with us. Thank you for calling us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about grand scale money laundering online. The sprawling world of criminal banking, we're told, and the story of Liberty Reserve, 5 arrests this week, and an alleged $6 billion money laundering operation busted. Brian Krebs is with us, investigative reporter, author of the KrebsOnSecurity.com daily blog on computer security and cybercrime. He knows this world inside and out. joins us from Arlington, Virginia. And with us right now from New York is Marcus Asner, former chief of the Major Crimes and Computer Hacking and Intellectual Property Unit for the Southern District of New York, prosecutor there, investigator. Now he's a litigator and partner at Arnold & Porter, LLP, specializes in white-collar crime defense, cases involving financial fraud and money laundering and cybercrime. Marcus Asner, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Does it look like a good case to you? Do you think we're going to see convictions here?
It looks like a terrific case, actually. I mean, they obviously put an awful lot of effort into this. And if you watched the press conference yesterday, Preet went on and sort of detailed some of the evidence that they had. And it's pretty astonishing. They talked about having wiretaps. I think he used the term countless interviews. And, you know, they had a number of jurisdictions being involved in the investigation. I think it were 17 different countries involved, multiple law enforcement agencies. So they've done their homework here. You know, it's always impossible to predict what will happen here. But they've got, you know, some of the best prosecutors in the world on this and some of the best agents. And it looks like a really, really strong case.
You were in there for law enforcement. Now you're on the other side of the table. Are you going to be defending Liberty Reserve, Marcus?
No. You know, I don't end up defending cases like this. I usually am working with legitimate companies that are getting, you know, that may get involved in, you know, one-off situations where there may be an individual, a rogue employee who does something. But, you know, if you read the indictment and you believe what's in the indictment, what they're describing is, you know, something that's rotten to the core. You know, obviously it's an indictment and the government bears the burden. But this is not describing a platform that is legitimate. These guys set this up intentionally in order to service the criminal underworld.
I want to look at what's going to be required to get convictions here if that's where we're headed. But let me throw out a big note of skepticism that some of our listeners are sounding online. Donnie says, Liberty's big mistake is that they didn't give enough to political campaigns. And Patrick says, you know, the Liberty Reserve should have given $100,000 in lobbying to federal officials. Then they might have gotten the wrist slap that HSBC did. Of course, HSBC was allegedly mixed up with terrorists and, I don't know, Mexican cartels and drug lord laundering. And, you know, what about our listeners saying, you know, there are very big famous banks who are not exactly lily clean here who are walking away. What, you know, Liberty Reserve just didn't grease the right palm.
Well, you could probably hear my eye rolling a little bit.
Okay,
on that.
Let's hear it.
I mean, you know, but you know, look, I think that you hear that stuff a lot, and the Department of Justice is, you know, it has a front office where they have political appointees, but most of the work is done by career prosecutors. And what they're really focused in on is going and getting the bad guys, and they're apolitical. And I think you can draw a distinction between an entity like Liberty Reserve that gets caught, you know, charged criminally, where Preet Bharara goes on television and says that, you know, effectively they're rotten to the core. This is a criminal organization. It's set up to service criminals, versus banks that may unwittingly be involved or may have a rogue employee who services criminals. And
HSBC unwittingly involved? It was quite a scale, wasn't it?
Well, look, I mean, you know, that's a different case, but HSBC is a legitimate bank, and it has a lot of you know, it has a lot of legitimate business throughout the world. Yeah. And while you may have a legitimate bank that may end up doing something wrong along the way, that's a far cry from an organization that's set up to be criminal.
Brian, you've got a foot in both worlds. How do you feel about that distinction? A lot of our listeners are skeptical about the, you know, apolitical power of the legitimate banks. But is this a different kettle of fish, Brian?
Well, I don't know. You know, it certainly is a different kettle of fish from regular Main Street banks. You know, there's been a lot of discussion on the underground forums of, you know, hey, people actually asking the question, which I think is a good and healthy thing. Hey, how come they didn't file these anti-money laundering documents? I mean, would it have killed them to do it?
You mean,
I
mean, Liberty Reserve could have done this legitimately, you're saying?
Right. Yeah. Maybe they could have tried just a little bit harder to achieve that veneer of legitimacy, but it doesn't even look like they bothered.
What's it going to take here, Marcus, to bring this to a conviction? I mean, there's a lot of anonymity here, deliberately arranged that way. Are they going to have to prove that the Liberty Reserve guys knew that they were abetting criminal money laundering?
Yeah, look, I mean, there is this, the knowledge is the key, and you put your finger on it. In any criminal, especially in a felony conviction, you have to prove that the person had the appropriate mental state. They call it mens rea in the criminal law. Mm. And so getting at the knowledge that somebody knowingly was involved in either money laundering or operating an unlicensed money remitter or money transmitter, that's the key to these convictions. Now, so the government gets at that number of ways. One thing they do is they do these wiretaps, and they talked about having multiple wiretaps. And you see some reflection of that in the indictment itself, where they cite to a statement made or a chat made by one of the alleged co-conspirators. Another thing they might do is they may try and develop a cooperator, a snitch essentially. And, you know, you notice there were 5 arrests around the world. These people are looking at significant time. And so it puts a big incentive on some of these people to cooperate.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Absolutely. And that's the name of the game, because when you're proving a conspiracy from the outside, it's hard. So you have to get inside the conspiracy. So you do that through wiretaps. You do that through documents. You do that through witness interviews, maybe an undercover. And here there was an undercover who tried to act as a criminal. But you also try and get an insider who tells the story for the jury. And that's an important part of any case.
Let's go to Daytona Beach, Florida, and Brendan. Hi, Brendan. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I understand the impulse to go after groups like this and companies like this, if you want to call them that. But I think we should be cautious and look at the piracy model as sort of the precursor to all of this. We went hard after groups like the Pirate Bay and Mega Upload, and now Pirate Bay literally has potentially millions of servers, so if one goes down, another one pops up instantly, creating an unstoppable force. And the most effective tactics we've actually had against piracy have been listening to consumers and setting up systems that let them legitimately and easily use the services they pay for. I think that going after companies like Liberty Reserve or, the one that no one's mentioned, Bitcoin, all you're going to do is push it harder and harder into the black market. And it's an inherently reactionary position, because the bad guys will always come up with something new.
That is a very interesting perspective. Let's pick it apart. Marcus, I hear you there first.
Yeah, sure. Look, I mean, it's true that the bad guys will always adapt, and law enforcement will adapt to what the bad guys are doing, and there'll be this constant race, and that's going to be going on. It's been going on for, as long as there's been law enforcement and bad guys. But, I think this is different, because what they're doing here is they're actually deciding as a strategic matter, this is my read on it, to go after the criminal infrastructure. And it's not necessarily going after the child pornographers or the drug dealers or the ATM thieves, but it's going after the way that they actually transfer money. And that's pretty important here. And I think it's a concerted effort. 20 years ago, they went after banks, where if banks had loose controls and didn't enforce the know your customer provisions, then they would go after the banks. And that ended up tightening the controls within banks. Legitimate banks willingly became regulated, and that led to sort of legitimacy here. I think what you're going to see is that legitimate companies who are interested in operating in the internet will actually welcome this sort of thing and look for regulation. But if you believe this indictment, what Liberty did here was essentially decide to circumvent any regulation whatsoever by moving to Costa Rica, lying to the authorities, with the main guy giving up his U.S. citizenship, et cetera.
Marrying a Costa Rican woman, that's being investigated now to see if he did that just so he could stay there. Of course, this is Arthur Brodovsky and Azzedine El Amin, arrested Friday at a Madrid airport while trying to return to Costa Rica. Our caller Brian, seems pretty savvy here, but got a lot of listeners wondering about some of the basics. Like Stephen writes to us online. He says, is web money and Liberty Reserve and all these, are these the same as Bitcoin? He says, I'm so uninformed on this topic.
Yeah.
But Brandon says, this gets us closer to Bitcoin. Are these the same animal or different? How different?
Right. Well, I want to address Brandon's point. There's a very attractive sort of analogy here, right? You look back in the 90s when the music industry went after Napster, right? And, and what happened? Well, they shut them down, but the peer-to-peer sites came up,
yep.
Right? And so there's a lot of discussion in the underground communities about using Bitcoin going forward as a method of payment.
Another digital currency which has been looked upon as pretty clean to this point. Has it not, Brian?
I think so. I mean, certainly there's places like the Silk Road where, you know, allegedly you can buy heroin or, you know, rocket launchers or whatever
using
you want.
Using Bitcoin.
But I think there's a lot of discussion going on in the underground now about, okay, so Liberty Reserve is gone, the money's gone. We got to start over. Where do we go? Who's going to be the next takedown?
You're saying the criminal world is talking this way,
yeah,
or the prosecution world?
No. So there are. I'm not kidding. There are like 50-page threads about this on certain forums, and there's a lot of heated discussion. And people are saying, look, the age of centralized current, digital currencies is over. I mean, peer to peer is what makes sense, but there are a few aspects of Bitcoin that set it apart, and I think. From the regular digital currencies, but I think it will prevent it from becoming a major vehicle for criminal commerce, at least in the short run.
But let me ask you, you just said something there. I want to get to your point, but you said you're going from digital currencies era is over, you got to go peer-to-peer. But the whole point is of a currency is that it has currency among a lot of people. How could that be peer-to-peer? You know what I mean? You can't make up your own dollars every time you interact with somebody.
So any of these networks, it's almost like a network effect, right? It becomes more useful as more users come online and start using it. And I think we're going to see that in the months and years ahead. This is like the media darling. Everybody wants to talk about Bitcoin. But there are a couple aspects of Bitcoin that really make it not so great for criminal commerce. One, let's say, take the example I used earlier. You're renting some spam service. And you pay a guy $500 a month to use his service, and he doesn't cash it out until the next day.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? There's a lot of fluctuation in that currency. You send him $500 today, it might be worth $300 tomorrow.
Right, or $5 or $5,000.
Or nothing. And really, that is a very big concern for folks in the underground. And the other issue is that unlike Liberty Reserve and Perfect Money and Web Money, there's actually a degree of transparency and traceability inherent in Bitcoin, even though it's a peer-to-peer currency, that doesn't exist in these other currencies. And that is anybody can see if you know the wallet number, they can see who you're, what other wallets you're transacting with, how often, how much money you have in your wallet, what the value of those transactions are, and that keeps that history. And indeed, the entire network works on that openness.
If it's heroin and rocket launchers, it may be see kind of those sums moving there. But how did Liberty Reserve keep its LR dollars steady? Was it because they were so closely linked to the U.S. dollar in their value?
Yeah, so the digital currencies, I'm not sure how they managed that, my guess is you're right about the keeping it close to U.S. dollars because it never changed. It was one LR equals $1. And the same thing with Perfect Money and, for the most part, Web Money.
And Tom, this is Marcus.
Yeah,
go
Marcus.
Ahead, sorry. Just let me add to what Brian was saying there a moment ago is that, if you watch the press conference yesterday and you read the indictment and the press release, the government goes to great pains to distinguish between what happened with Liberty Reserve and legitimate internet online payment processors. And so I think that that's a distinction that was very intentional. They're not saying get out of this space. What they're saying is if you're going to be in this space, we're going to regulate you.
Tom, just one more point on that. Bitcoin also has a pressure point that the other virtual currencies do as well, and that is it's useful in only pretty much as it has value in the Bitcoin network. So that means, if you can pay people with Bitcoins, that's great. We're really not there yet. So, having a huge Bitcoin balance isn't so great unless you can pull the money out. Well, to put money in and to take it out requires the same sort of exchange networks that Liberty Reserve and others rely on. And I think it's worth noting that the government's case, they seized, I think, the domains for five of these exchanges that were working very closely with Liberty Reserve, and they're trying to see something like 40 others of the exchanges. So
watch out. It's a big move here. Let me get one more call. David in Chesapeake, Virginia. David, you're on the air. Our time is short. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thanks. Yeah, I really see this as the banks kind of pushing the issues that they are part of and responsible for into, another arena to get that focus off of them. I had a case that situation happened in 2008 right after the banks approved the fees of international charges. I made a purchase in U.S. with a U.S. company online. That U.S. company was using a consulting firm data processor out of the country, and then that that company was using subs in Portugal, you know, little small rinky-dink card processors.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I made the one-time purchase. I ended up having 23 transactions go through. The bank collected fees on each transaction. The company took $1,090. I called, and this was a major bank in the U.S. I called their fraud department and said, hey, you know, I didn't authorize this. What's going on? Blah, blah. Can you check into it? All I got was a question, did you authorize or willfully give your information across the internet to this company, meaning the U.S. company?
I said,
yes. They said, well, can't help you.
So you give your information and boom, you're in the Wild West, and that's where that's hard to sustain. David, I appreciate your call. Marcus, what about it? Is this an effort to get us out of the Wild West here? Or do these companies, you know, Web Money and Perfect Money and Cash U and Liberty Reserve, if it hadn't been for this, grow up and become the big banks of the 21st century?
You know, I think the Wild West analogy is exactly right. I mean, I think what you have is, you know, keep in mind the internet is still relatively new and it's developing. And things like online money payment processors is still something that's relatively new. And so there are going to be companies that are going to try and do this legitimately, and there are going to be companies that are going to try and cheat and take advantage of it. And so I think, Preet Bharara said it's the Wild West, and I think that's exactly right. And they're just making a move into this area.
It's a big move this week on a $6 billion operation, we're told. I've learned a lot in this hour. I'm guessing our listeners have as well, and we're grateful to the two of you for helping us out there. Marcus Asner, formerly with the Major Crimes in Computer Hacking and Intellectual Property Unit at the Southern District of New York, now with Arnold & Porter LLP. Marcus, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And Brian Krebs with his KrebsOnSecurity.com blog. You're the best, Brian. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Tomorrow we look at the political theory of Hannah Arendt. Join us for that. Thanks for being here today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.